Hi everyone. So welcome back to the podcast. So today we're joined by Eric Barnes. So hi Eric. So usually people like to ask, what's your kind of background? What do you do? But I want to ask you about your love for minivans and F1. So could you share a bit about that?
Yeah, certainly. Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm excited to be here. And it's sort of strange how that sort of developed into one of my public brands is my love for weird large vans that can haul your family as well as fast cars too. I guess with regard to the minivan stuff, it's at least in the United States, there's this kind of meme that goes around that if you drive a minivan, you've kind of given up in life. Like, you know, you're trying not to impress anyone. But, you know, for me, like a minivan was this really amazing moment in my life when we got one as a family, because it meant that I had this wonderful family I get to carry around. And from a utility perspective, they're just amazing vehicles. I mean, the doors slide, they can carry lots of stuff, and it's just a real blast. And I kind of just like trying to make minivans cool. That's my thing, even though I'm probably gonna be unsuccessful. And so with regards to the F1 stuff, that's like a pandemic thing. When I started sitting at home, I really got into Drive to Survive, the Netflix series on F1. But that kind of led to my starting to watch the races and get really into the engineering behind F1. And now it's like a full-on obsession where I'm trying to get into faster cars myself. It's been kind of a really cool hobby and journey.
That's amazing that, you know, you still constantly put out content on minivans, even though, you know, your audience may not be receptive to it. You're still building your personal brand in that way. And that's kind of your anchor, like your anchor as your personal brand. So I love what you're doing with Uncapped Notes. I'm not a founder myself, but I've listened to all your episodes thus far, most of them at least. And I'm really loving the content that you and the Hustle team are putting out there. So what's the secret sauce behind your content strategy over at Hustle Fun?
Yeah, thank you. And this sort of does relate to the minivan thing. So one of the big problems with the VC industry is that it's really difficult for a fund to differentiate itself in front of founders. They frankly all look and sound the same. But when we started Hustle Fund back in 2017, we wanted to tell a different kind of story to founders that's driven by authenticity and irreverence, and also making fun of ourselves and the industry a little bit too, because we don't want to take ourselves too seriously, but we want to take the work seriously. So the thing around the minivans, and this does relate to Uncapped Notes, is, you know, for me, I think I'm a pretty wholesome dad kind of person. And that attracts certain kinds of personalities that I also like to work with who also appreciate this, and also kind of deters other founders who maybe not like that kind of stuff. And those tend to be the folks I don't enjoy working with either. So there's a little bit of a selection bias thing behind that kind of a brand. But in addition to that too, you know, when it comes to things like Uncapped Notes, which is our series on YouTube, where we you know, break down basic concepts around venture and fundraising and startups. For me, that's an opportunity for us to also put out our voice, which is fun and irreverent too, while being educational. And I'll tell you like what the secret was, which was, you know, for us, the big unlock for our fund was realizing the core persona that we want to use when it comes to talking about ourselves. A 10-year-old girl who is super sarcastic, but a closet idealist. And that is the exact persona that describes Hustle Fund. I think that's a really authentic description of us, but also is the filter by which we try to produce all content. And I think that really does differentiate us as well as make things a little more fun.
Biggest things you can take from Hustle Fund is how you built up your personal brand, not just as a person, but also for your fund as well, and how you're doing that strategically through Twitter. So my next question to you is, so could you share a bit about getting pitched by Eric Zhu from the school bathroom, and what made that specific pitch stand out?
Yeah, well, so for those of you who don't know, Eric is a 15-year-old kid. He's a high school student in the Midwest, and he's actually still in high school. Young man. He was referred to me by this awesome VC. Her name is Jess Lozano. She's now at JetBlue Ventures, a rising Gen Z star, VC star. And so she put me in touch with Eric. She said that this is a special guy. I get onto a Zoom call with him, and it was totally weird. He had occupied the largest stall in the boys' room. I asked him what was going on. He told me that he had pretended he had stomach issues with his teacher and was going to spend the next 25 minutes on the toilet. And that's actually how he pitched me, was talking about his company, Aviato. And it's just like Silicon Valley show, Aviato. And, you know, he went through his pitch. I heard other boys using the toilets and talking in the background, too. But he actually delivered an amazing pitch. Now, we didn't invest a hustle fund, but just out of the pure moxie and I guess courageousness that I saw from this kid, I personally invested a little bit of money. And, you know, it's one of those opportunities where, you know, you meet this founder. There's just something so special about wanting to see what this journey is like ahead. And the ideas are not terribly well formed in the beginning, to be honest. But he really knows how to execute and build. And it's been such a pleasure seeing him, I guess, work and grow up and do his meetings through these bathrooms. And hopefully at some point he'll get out of the bathroom.
Yeah, hopefully as well. And Eric is known for a lot of legend for shitposting on the internet. So yeah, credits to him and whoever is coming up with this content strategy, because it's really working out for him very well. So my next question is, so what are your thoughts on young founders? Yeah, sure. So like, what is your perspective on young founders and how can they be better supported by the ecosystem?
Well, can you just maybe expand upon that question beyond like what kinds of thoughts are you asking about? Okay, great. Thank you. I mean, obviously, I'm a big fan of founders of all ages, whether you're really far along in your career and then starting off, or you're even like someone like Eric, who's still juggling high school and trying to build a business. You know, I'm all for it. Building something new in this world takes a lot of courage, and is also the reason why we have so much innovation. When it comes to younger founders, though, I specifically think about, you know, one of the ways that we need to support them more is helping them to understand great mental models. When I started my career, I worked at a large software company called Intuit. It's a large business that builds accounting software, tax software, a little bit boring, but extremely well run. And the benefit that I had when I was young out of college was that I had so many great managers who were so well trained, and they took time to actually mentor me, to teach me things like, this is best practices around marketing, or here's how you build a great like product requirements document. This is how you relate with engineers and so forth. So I've really built upon those foundations of great mental models. I do empathize with founders who may be younger, just out of school, who haven't had those kinds of experiences or similar mentorship. And it is a little bit harder if you're lacking it. You're gonna have to find that mentorship elsewhere and actually invest yourself in that time to understand what good looks like. And I think that's kind of the big question I'm still asking myself in my realm, which is, you know, what does good look like? And it's not terribly obvious. And often I have to turn to mentors as well.
Amazing. And I loved your point on finding mentors. So my next question to you is, before we do a deep dive into Hustle Fund, your investment thesis and other things like that, so what's your take on the San Fran and VC space? And do you think it's becoming too crowded?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people each year who declare that San Francisco is dead or the Bay Area is dead. And for context, for those who may not have as much history around Silicon Valley, you know, Silicon Valley is actually roughly the location between San Francisco and San Jose. There's a peninsula here in the Bay Area where so many great companies and so much startup activity traditionally has been created. And sometime in the last 15 years, the location of a lot of these startups moved from places like Mountain View, Palo Alto. These are areas in like the mid to lower peninsula part of Silicon Valley centered around Stanford University. It shifted upwards towards San Francisco. And no doubt, especially in the more recent years around the pandemic, we've seen a lot of problems in San Francisco. It's really expensive now. It's also has a lot more crime. It's a little bit dirtier than needs to be. Yet, it's almost impossible to kill off that city. It's burned down 7 times in the history of San Francisco, and it's always been rebuilt and rebuilt stronger. And I actually think that we're going through the metaphorical rebuild right now. AI startups are blowing up like crazy in Hayes Valley, which is a really cool neighborhood in San Francisco. I'm working out of the Ferry Building on the eastern side of the city. It is full of people. And when it comes to the Bay Area, the thing that is going to be so difficult for any other region to replicate is the density of amazing tech talents who are still so close to you. I mean, I walk down the street and I meet founders all the time because they just all like to live near one another. And that's not to say that I don't want other great hubs to grow too. I think it's important, actually, that Silicon Valley is not so concentrated in just a single location. I know that you're based in Singapore, for example. I actually am very long on Singapore, and we actually have a team in Singapore too, because I think that that also has so much possibilities. But this isn't quite your question. I think I'll just conclude by saying, my hope is that these emerging hubs don't try to just completely replicate Silicon Valley, but actually create their own version of what they are in terms of talent. Like Singapore should be the Singapore of Singapore. Miami should be the Miami of Miami. London should be the London of London, and so forth. And we can all win together.
Yeah, these are some great points. So now I wanted to dive deeper into your point on Singapore. So what exactly excites you about Singapore? Why are you long on Singapore?
There's so many reasons I'm long on Singapore. So from besides the fact that it's a really business-friendly government, and there's a lot of advantages from a tax perspective for founders as well as investors to be there, I see it actually as the emerging new Switzerland, but maybe for tech. So there's a little bit of a cold war that seems to be brewing between China and the United States, and this is sort of a legacy of the last several years. So it's really difficult, I think, to do business between the two. Yet there's Singapore in the middle, which is friendly to both. So there's a lot of foreign direct investment from the West that tends to happen in Singapore, usually traditionally from financial markets, but also in China, repatriated over into that region. So there's a lot of wealth being accumulated in this one place. And in addition to that too, Singapore is just like a really natural hub for founders to live if they still need access even to other greater parts of Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Thailand, places like East Asia are really accessible and pretty easy flights from Singapore. And just from a quality of life perspective, I mean, I'm biased because I have I'm a little bit of an older person. So like I have family, you know, I worry about the safety and education of my kids. Like I challenge pretty much anyone to find a better place for raising a family, and the food is great and all that stuff too. So it's a little city, but I think it has unbelievable strategic potential when it comes to having a voice in the tech ecosystem, and is a very tempting place for even someone like myself to move someday.
That's great that you're so invested in Singapore, and I love to see that from US VCs and American people in general. So now I wanted to kind of pivot away from all that. And first I wanted to get started with, so how do you write a good cold email?
Oh man, that's a really interesting question. So it's hard. You know, I had a conversation with my colleague, Elizabeth Thien. She's one of our co-founders at Hustle Fund. And, you know, one of the points that she made, this is actually just yesterday even, was that when you're younger, you know, again, one of the benefits of working at a bigger organization like an Intuit or Google or something that's pretty established, Procter & Gamble, is that your mentors actually take time to teach you how to do this kind of stuff. In high school, college, no one actually really puts a course together on what is a good email. But there are a couple of good elements of a good email. One is this brief. The second is that it has a clear call to action at the top. And then the bottom, usually. And normally, if you can communicate your points in bullets, that's very readable. I think that's a really good cold email, or email just in general. And when it comes to, a cold pitch or cold email for an investor, or even to like a potential client to buy your services, I think those are the elements that I try to train too, which is it's got to be brief, try to do it in bullets, simple language, call to action early and also at the very end. And I got to say, I get a lot of cold emails every day, and maybe 1% of them follow those kinds of rules. And this is actually a really good reminder, Ruby, for me to potentially put together an Uncapped Notes YouTube episode on how to write an email. Because, again, I think this is a mental model of what good looks like that no one really proactively ever teaches anyone. Yeah. You know, so we're a pre-seed stage fund. So the stage that we like to invest in teams is really early. Typically, it you know our most common co-investors are like family members or friends or other angels, more so than other VC funds. So we're trying to find teams that have usually just gone full time to start working on their company. They might have produced perhaps a prototype of what their product looks like, and that's about it. So that's the early stage that we like to get into. We don't typically invest in any companies at the idea stage. That's even a little bit too early for us. So when it comes to our thesis, we think that the very best leading indicator of success is this quality that we call hustle. So for us, hustle is defined as great execution means high velocity. And you know, today, and I'd say traditionally in Silicon Valley, but I think also I find this quite a bit more in places like Southeast Asia and East Asia. You know, when it comes to pre-seed and seed stage companies, there's been, I think, a lot of emphasis on things like pedigree. You know, where did you go to college? Did you work at a FAANG company before this? As also things like phenotype too. You know, are you a white or Asian man that went to like MIT and Stanford, worked at a FAANG company? Are you wearing a Patagonia vest and Allbirds shoes, like some of the uniforms of Silicon Valley? And because at the pre-seed and seed stages, there's a lack of data, like there's no like product market fit yet, or the product might even still be kind of crappy. You're still making the majority of your investment decision on what you think the quality of the team is and the potential of the market. But our view is that, you know, when it comes to hustle, that actually cuts through all the noise. There are great hustlers that look like anyone and come from anywhere. That's actually our mantra for our fund, is great hustlers look like anyone and come from anywhere. And the way that you can actually differentiate is by working with the teams. So this actually informs our investment model. We first start by writing a lot of small $50,000 checks into a lot of teams. Last month, we saw 1,000 deals, and we wrote checks into about 7 companies. So we pace at about 7 investments per month at this initial check level. Next, we'll then work with the team on a growth project, usually related to sales or user acquisition. To do that, we actually created a sales on customer acquisition and growth called Redwood School. It's only available for our portfolio companies. And we'll also pair up the founders that we just invested with 2 mentors who are relevant growth experts in their space, as well as a general partner like myself. And we'll have this period of time, generally between 6 and 8 weeks, to work together to help you try to push some growth metrics. This gives our team a much better sense of witnessing your hustle and learning about your market. But for the founders, more importantly, it also gives them a chance to judge us, to see whether we are a VC firm that's actually adding real value, that seems like good humans, seems like partners you want to work with for the long term. And if we really vibe together and like each other's hustle, like the market opportunity, that's when we'll concentrate a second and third larger check into your business to make you what we call a core position within our fund. So think of it like dating before marriage. And I've had some really good VCs and investors and really terrible ones. And the problem was they all sounded great in the beginning. And what we found is that what I found in my experience was like, it wasn't until 6 weeks in, 6 months in, 6 years in of working with my investors where I could differentiate through their hustle and their attitudes by working together who was really good and who wasn't. So I like this balance of power between founder and investor in our model.
I would love to see that. And I'll always be following along your journey of Uncapped Notes. So my next question to you, so what is Hustle Fund's investment thesis?
Yeah, that's a very big topic and probably a 3-hour podcast we could produce at some point. But I'd say that there's a few things that really matter when you're first starting out. So I'm going to narrow the context, which is like, how do you pitch when you're trying to raise your first fund? So I think there are a few things that really worked for us. One was we spent a lot of time making sure that we had a decent story to go out with. So there are a lot of emerging managers out there, and their problem is that they don't seem differentiated at all. They all say the same things like, oh, we have like a unique pipeline of deals. I'm just smarter at picking than others, and so forth. And when we came up with our fund's thesis around, like, you know, we actually have a model for collaborating with people to actually assess hustle and then like enter the sort of arrangement where we mutually are excited to work together and concentrate more investment. That in itself was unique. I still don't know of any pre-seed or seed fund that operates like us in the world today. So unique thesis was good. An unfair advantage that we also had, and this is truly unfair, and I don't really know whether this is actionable, is me and Elizabeth were pretty active angels when we started Hustle Fund for about a decade. And we actually did have some pretty substantial wins in our own personal portfolios. So maybe like the actionable thing is, like, if you're not looking to raise a fund for a few years, perhaps starting to do a little bit of angel investing first. And you can start with like angelist syndicates and things like that, just so you can show that you have some sort of picking track record is important, because that's something that we relied upon a lot. But the last is this, which is our attitude towards fundraising. We thought that, you know, we could be the best at pitching in the world, but it's not going to matter. It's always going to be hard. So what we have to do is never run out of leads. In the 9 months that it took for us to raise Hustle Fund One, which was $11.5 million, we pitched 700 prospective investors. And our view was just like, if we just do as many pitches as possible, then we will eventually get to some number that's acceptable to us. And about 70 out of the 700 decided to invest in Hustle Fund to get us to that $11.5 million first fund. There's a lot to be said in terms of how we got those leads, but it was a combination of a lot of warm referrals from friends, as well as like hosting events, it was quite a journey. But prepare yourself just to brute force your way through lots of meetings to get it done, and then it does get easier with subsequent funds as you start to prove that you can do your job.
Question is, so yeah, I love what you guys are doing at Hustle and how you're supporting founders. So my next few questions are going to be more a masterclass for the audience in how to actually be a fund manager. So you've done a stellar job as a fund manager. So now I would like to hear from you any advice on how do you pitch your fund as a fund manager?
Well, I think the first and most important thing that I focus on is making sure that they, one, truly understand your thesis, and then two, understand that there's a good fit LP and bad fit LP for any kind of specific kind of fund. So on the point of truly understanding, now that we're on to fund three, which we raised last year, you know, I am operating a monthly newsletter list for our LPs that updates the performance of the fund, our views of the market, and so forth. And we have put out this newsletter since inception. So it's now over 5 years where every month we're sharing what's happening within our fund. When I meet with a prospect, one of the things I like to offer is an invitation to actually see that LP newsletter and join it. And this gives them oftentimes months or years of an opportunity to actually see what we're doing. And I think that is a great way to prime a fundraising conversation with those folks after they've had a chance to witness our work. That's the first part. And then in terms of fit, you know, this one takes a little bit more time to understand, but when you're an emerging manager, one of the big mistakes is that fund managers will try to get a meeting with like the Yale Endowment or GIC in Singapore or something. But those funds, those really large institutional LPs, investors, don't typically like to invest in the first fund, especially a small first fund. You know, they're trying to deploy like $100 million at a time into something a little bit more established. So you probably would have been better off understanding that the better profile would be high net worth individuals or family offices or maybe smaller fund of funds. So there's a little bit of a Goldilocks kind of experiment to make sure that it's, you know, not too big, not too small, but just right. And for emerging managers, I think leaning into high net worth and family office is probably a better selection of LPs to work with versus the other parties, which might be better later.
I think my biggest takeaway from everything you've discussed is to have a picking track record. Yeah, that's a great point you shared. And I think even Harry Stebbings, in his newest podcast, even he shared something similar along those lines. So my last question to you is, so how does Hustle Fund source the startups and how do you guys do your due diligence?
Yeah. So we, as I mentioned, see about 1,000 deals a month. And it's a pretty amazing volume. What I like to credit is that we think that we view ourselves as much as an education company as we are a VC fund. And what that means is that we have a very large team that's dedicated towards content and marketing. People are surprised to understand that our team is actually 30 people now. And the majority of them are not investors. They're actually people that are helping to produce things like our YouTube content or even our blogs, our newsletters. There's a lot of initiatives, events. And our view is that, you know, there's always going to be a person in the pre-seed space, a new founder who's new in town, doesn't know anything about venture or even some of the basic concepts around startups. So if we can constantly produce content to educate these newcomers and welcome them to the ecosystem, then that's going to naturally benefit us into deals. Sort of like how Coca-Cola spends insane amounts of marketing to talk about Coca-Cola. I mean, everyone knows them, but I think they have the right attitude, which is let's spend the most on content and marketing and then remain number one. That's our view. So I think that's a big part of the sourcing. In terms of deal selection, again, it's so early. This is a bet on the team, but I typically look for things like team, problem, solution, market, traction, these five basic pillars of understanding like whether this is an opportunity for us. And there's a really simple mathematical question too that we think about, which is at the post-money valuation that we can invest in this given founder's company, do we think that there's an opportunity for us to 100x our money? So if we can 100x our investment, that will more than return the fund, which means like, you know, give back the original capital to our investors and get us into this wonderful profit sharing.
That's amazing that you guys do so many community initiatives and you've got a ton of educational content. So what's next for Hustle Fund?
Yeah, I think we just double down in terms of our strategy. We are expanding a lot more content and events in the coming year. That's something that's very exciting. And then in addition to that too, you know, we just launched our third fund in August with $46 million. So we need to deploy that into great founders. And I'm actually excited about the downturn ahead in some ways, in the sense that I think very gritty founders will build during these kinds of periods of downturns and can emerge during the bull markets in a very big way. So excited about what our team can accomplish when it comes to the investing ahead.